Okay, so I just tried to finish what we interrupted yesterday, and then we'll restart with the second chapter. Okay, yesterday we were talking about enzymes and proteins that were interacting with chromatin, if you remember, and we described a little bit the what we call it erasers, readers, and writers, and the additional thing that I didn't tell you yesterday, we didn't have time, was that actually many times these enzymes go together. Okay, so many times you don't find only a single enzyme taking care of any particular histone modification, but they usually are found together, like is illustrated in this figure, in which you have writer, reader, and erasers in the same complex. And so this is the reason why, if you remember, many times we see coordinated modification on histones. Okay, we always find, for example, I don't know, deacetylated position with another methylated position and so on. So this is the reason why this happens. Actually, this kind of complexes of enzyme are also very important, and you will see in the next week, to maintain the identity of chromatin domains, but we will talk about it, okay? So, of course, all these studies are made with chromatin immunoprecipitation, so when we know that an enzyme or a erasers or whatever else is present in a specific point, in a specific genomic location, this is, of course, made by chromatin immunoprecipitation, you know that, okay? And the last thing that we have to discuss that was left over yesterday was the histone isoform. This is another completely different story in the sense that we used to know that nucleosomes are composed by histone 2A, 2B, 3, and 4, as we saw yesterday. But actually, this is true only partially because many isoforms of histones exist. Okay? So each of the types of histones is not encoded by a single gene, but there are several genes encoding for slightly different histones. Okay? So they are called isoforms, of course. And they have different functions. For example, this is one histone variant, okay, that is called SEN-PA, and it is found only in nucleosomes that stays in centromeres, so in the middle part of chromosomes, okay. And the reason for this is that actually this histone is extended. It has a little extension as compared to the normal histone, and this will be bound by the proteins interacting with senatocore. Okay, so this is the reason why in that particular nucleus, in those particular nucleosomes, you find this kind of protein. Okay, let's look. SEN-PA is an isoform of H3A. Sorry, H3, not H3. Okay, so if you look here, I don't know if you can see quite. Wait, I go there to see whether you see or not. Yeah, more or less, not really very good. Anyway, okay, so what is in this slide? You see, this is H3, and this is the amino acid sequence of normal H3, okay, the first line. This is the number 50, and then you go there, and so on, 100, and then 149. That is the length of this histone, okay? And then you find in the second line here, and in the third line, you see another two isoforms of H3. One is called H3.3, and the other one is called SEN-PA. That is the one that we saw before in the scheme. And as you can see, many of the amino acids are the same, okay? but in many other positions they are a little different. Please note that the secondary structure is always the same. So this part is organized in alpha helix, this part again, and this part again, and so on. Okay, so the general structure of the histones is not changed, but what is changed is a little bit sequence. Okay, so this SEN-PA is extended here. The sequence is not shown, but you have an extension in C-terminus that is the one which is bound by centromere protein. Okay, so the other one here is H2A, and as you can see, you have H2AZ, that is one of the isoform. Then you have another one that is called macro H2A. Then you have H2AX and H2ABBD. And actually, I'm not going to make all systematics of the histone isoform, but just to show you that there exist many isoforms of the histones. And okay, they are deposited in specific situation. Okay, so you don't find isoforms spread all around the chromatin, but only in specific positions. Okay, for example, this MPA that I told you, and then H3.3 that is very very often found in genes that are reactivated. Imagine a gene that has been used in a and a particular developmental stage, and then it's heterochromatic, so it's silenced in some way. Then for any reason, this gene will be reactivated during a later phase of the development. And in that case, you will find this H3.3 isoforms in the nucleosomes that are over the gene that is reactivated. This is probably due to the fact that it's much easier to signal to the apparatus the presence of a novel situation, just erasing all the epigenetic marks that are on the histones before, just changing the kind of histones that you have inside. Okay, you see here some more information about the story. For example, H3.3 has only 4 amino acids variation as compared to the normal H3, is deposited in chromatin also outside S phase. So it is, as I told you, is exchanged in reactivated genes, and that is the story. This H2AZ in Cerevisia is incorporated near silenced regions, for example, and will inhibit the spread of chromatin. So they have specific function. They are not completely understood, but in some way they are. And you will see in the next lesson that, for example, when we will study enhancers, enhancers as regulatory sequences, and very often the two nucleosomes that just flank the enhancer section, they have this kind of isoforms inside, so kind of special thing. Okay. Then we had also a modification of DNA in heterochromatin as compared to euchromatin, but probably you, this 5-methyl cytosine story, you know. So I probably skip these slides. Do you agree with that? Do you know where the Do you want me to pass the slides anyway? You remember this modification? Please say yes or not. Yes, you know. Okay, so it's just to say that in heterochromatin you have enriched methylation. Okay, so it's a kind of, again, a common mark to heterochromatin. We will take it again studying epigenetics, so don't worry about it. Okay, just remember this is methyl cytosine. Okay. Good. And we'll see how it works in the next lessons. Okay, so we can, at this point, we can open the lesson that was actually for today. Okay, this one. Good. Okay. Good. So as you can see, we are jumping to the second chapter, second part of the course. But remember that we have still to discuss the first research paper. Okay, so next Monday we will discuss the first research paper that actually is in the first chapter, in the first part. Okay? So please again read it carefully, because it's very important. You have to know it, to understand everything on that paper, because it will be required at the exam. Okay, so what we discussed today and starting the second part is genomes and epigenomes. And we'll start today with genomes, of course. And I have few slides in which you have only text, but I try to read it through because it's important. Okay, we have seen in the last lessons how the genome is physically organized in different forms, different states, as you want. Okay, and this is done both by nuclear compartmentalization, we have seen in the first lessons, and by histone and non-histone protein modulation. Okay, all the modification we have studied yesterday. Okay, the specific thing is that this kind of modification is not made in a, I say pulverized, that means it's not a kind of spread over around, but the chromatin is divided, genome is divided in domains, okay? So we will find big domains that are completely heterochromatic and other domains that are completely euchromatic. Okay, so it's a kind of mega division of parts of the chromosomes. Okay, when we look a little bit more inside the function of the different parts, instead of talking simply of euchromatic or euchromatin and heterochromatin, we have to further subdivide heterochromatin in two parts. These are conceptual parts more than physical parts. Okay, that is what usually biologists call constitutive heterochromatin and facultative heterochromatin. As I told you, this is a kind of philosophical category, in the sense that from the point of view of molecular biology, they are much the same. Okay. But the difference is that constitutive heterochromatin, you find those parts, exactly the same parts, heterochromatic in all the cells. Okay, so this is the definition. While facultative heterochromatin, as I think that is clear to you, are parts in which you can have active or not active depending on the cell type or the developmental stages, and so on. So, the question that we try to understand this morning is, what are the determinants of these states? So what will, in some sense, tell the chromatin to organize in one way or the other way, okay? What is the mechanism leading to domain uniformity, and what is the mechanism of giving boundaries between the domain? Okay, this is the story. And finally, is the chromatin status inheritable mitotically? This is a very important point from the biological point of view. Because I don't know if you ever made this kind of thinking, but imagine a cell which is part of a tissue, okay? Something like, I don't know, epithelium is the easiest way to go, okay? The skin, I mean, you have in the epithelial side, you have, as you remember, you have keratinized cells on the surface, and then you have pre-differentiated cells in the middle, and then you have normal epithelial cells in the that contact the basal stratus, okay, and there you have cells dividing, okay. So if you look at mitosis, you will find all the mitosis in the basal layer. You remember that? Okay, good. Now, the idea is, when you have a mitosis, of course, the organization of chromatin that we have studied last week, yesterday, and so on, of course, is reorganized. You remember very well that the chromosome will condense, make the rods that everybody knows, okay? After division, of course, you have replication of DNA, then you have all this kind of formation, and in metaphase you have this rods chromosome that will be separated and so on. So then in the new daughter cells, this chromosome will diffuse again, will become interphasic chromosome, as we have studied. So the question is, do the daughter cell reproduce all the developmental stages that the mother has made before, or there is any kind of information that is resisting this harsh recombination, harsh reorganization of the chromosome, and will be there directing again in the daughter cells the same organization of chromatin that was in the daughters, in the mother? What do you think? Okay, it happens sometimes. So what do you think? The second one, okay? It's almost impossible that the cell remake, say, all the paths to arrive to a differentiated state, okay? So what is this kind of information? We call this epigenetic information. So epigenetic information means something that is not the DNA sequence, of course. The DNA sequence is there, it is always the same, okay, in all cells. And it's something that is over or under epigenetics, okay, that tells the daughter cells to make the same story. It means that if you have a heterochromatic domain in a particular place of the chromosome, this will be marked in some way, okay, that when the daughter cells make it again, will be heterochromatic again. Of course, if there is no differentiation change, because you know that sometimes you have an equal mitosis in which you have a production of two different cells. In that case, of course, you have different statuses of the of chromatin. Okay. So, if we try to rationalize this kind of discussion, it means that the genome, in some way, is during development, is programmed, okay, is programmed to have a particular chromatin situation, and this situation will be, in some sense, conserved during the following mitosis in differentiated cells, and so we call them, from a point of view of genetics and molecular biology, we call this establishment of the chromatin patterns or profile, and then the maintenance of this epigenetic information. So you have two distinct phases in which you have the two story. Okay. Okay, and in the end of this second chapter, we will also study a kind of interesting phenomenon in which we have seen that certain characters in an organism, in a mother or a father, are transmitted to the next generation, not following the classic Mendelian rules, but following a little different story. And this is called the transgenerational epigenetic inheritance, and we will see how it works. Okay, so we will try to see what are the determinants of chromatic states, okay, and the second, we will see how this information is managed locally, so in the domains, as I told you, and finally, how this information is passed on urine cell division. Okay, so I had, what is the definition of epigenetics is exactly following the discussion that we made. Okay, so the first definition of epigenetic is any kind of information that is not contained in the DNA sequence, but can be transmitted mitotically. This is the older definition of epigenetics. And if you look at the, I opened this morning a new textbook in Moodle. This is the author, Campos. We'll discuss in this text, in this review, all the stories that we are discussing now. And he says the inheritance of a phenotype in a manner that is independent of the DNA sequence and that remains self-perpetuating in the absence of the initial stimulus that determined the phenotype in the parental cell. Okay, so what it means is a kind of more elaborated declaration, but actually it's the same. Means that there is, in any cell during development, you have a stimulus that will input a specific information to become something, okay? So to differentiate in something. And this information will stay in the cells independent of the stimulus, okay? So independent of what was actually beginning this kind of differentiation. Okay, so the first question that we are trying to afford today, the only one for today, is does DNA sequence influence chromatin organization? And this is an important question because, of course, you may think that everything is done by epigenetic information, okay? But actually, the DNA sequence does influence chromatic information. Okay, for three reasons. Okay, the evidence one is that some of the chromatin structures are intrinsic. Okay, and strictly depends on the DNA sequence itself. I told you there are one part of the heterochromatin is called constitutive. This means that the sequence of DNA directs formation of this heterochromatin independently of any kind of other epigenetic information. And actually, two lessons ago, we also discussed the fact that when you have a repetitive transgene, you remember, it will induce heterochromatization. It's the same. When you have a specific arrangement of sequences, you always see heterochromatic formation. So in this case, means that the sequence itself is determining heterochromatization. The evidence two is that we say that chromatin organization follows a domain rule. And so, of course, if it follows a domain rule, means that the domain are in some sense, in some way, defined. Okay? So it means that you have boundaries that will define the length of this domain. Okay, these sequences are called insulators and are specific sequences of DNA that will mark the borders or the ends of the domains. Okay, and the third point is this one. So whenever we talk about signals, before we say we have a signal that will input the cell, for example, differentiating in some way or making any kind of storage. The most easy way to go is to think about a growth factor hitting a cell and saying, okay, divide. This is an information telling the cells do something, okay? So now, what is the, you know already very well, but what is the meaning, the mechanical working of this signal The signal will reach probably a receptor on the surface. The receptor will activate, I don't know, a kinase cascade or something like this. And then finally you have phosphorylation of a transcription factor that will bind specific genes and tell the genes, okay, go, transcribe. Okay? Transcribe and make new proteins. Okay? Where do the transcription factor bind? Of course, to specific sequences. And again, it means that transcription factor binding sites, small sequences, will determine what happens to that particular piece of DNA. And if that particular piece of DNA was heterochromatic, it will become euchromatic, okay? Because it has to be active to transcribe, okay? So we have three, a big one, a little intermediate one sequence, and a small sequence that actually are determinants of chromatin structure. Okay, so we have to open a parenthesis. This is a parenthesis. Because in the previous lesson, I made you some questions, and I realized that all of you have a clear idea of how our genome is organized. And so probably it's better if we go through, to spend 1 hour or something to go through our organization, just to make something clear, okay? Then if you know everything, please tell me, okay? So we will see DNA sequence, Human Genome Project, NGS, human variation, databases, and composition. So I put a link in the very last chapter of the Moodle site in which you can see what was the Genome Project. When you were all small kids, the scientists finished the first version of the human genome, and it was a terrible task, because in that time the only thing that we had was Sanger sequencing. Have you heard about Sanger sequencing? It's a pain in the ass. You say, oh, sorry, it's a pain in the neck. Better, politically correct. Okay. So it's really hard, and actually the other problem was that the scientists didn't have any idea about how the genome was organized. Okay, so they spent, the project started in this year more or less, and was actually Italy-born American scientist that was pushing very hard, was the Nobel Prize Dulbecco. You remember Dulbecco? You have heard about it. Him. He was working in California at the end of his life, and he was pushing very hard to make this kind of project, and actually started in 1991, and there were something like 23 laboratories around the world making this kind of story. And from the first 8 years, they didn't do any sequencing. They were just putting labels. Putting labels means that you have to imagine to try to make a very detailed map of a region, of a territory, okay? Making pictures from a low resolution photos that you take by plane or something. Not high resolution photos as we can do today, but low resolution photos, okay? So you will see a territory, okay, and then you have like dots that will be maybe villages, okay, and then you see lines that may be roads, maybe rivers, maybe railways. You don't know because you have not enough resolution to see clearly. So what they did was to try to put labels and try to recognize these labels, okay? So saying, okay, when I see a kind of round things, clear and reddish or something, this is a village, and then the other one is a road, and so on and so on. So they try to make this. And they use very complicated technologies like fish, that you know, so small sequences that they knew already, because of course in those years individual laboratories had already cloned some gene. Okay, so we already knew a little number of genes, and using that probes they were trying to localize and to map on the chromosomes, and it was extremely hard work. It took something like 8 years to have a complete physical mapping of all the chromosomes. So at that point they started to sequence, but the sequence, as you know, in Sanger, it's a completely different approach that we use today with NGS, because you have to clone each individual fragment of DNA. Okay? So you have to take chromosomes that are extremely long, as you can imagine. Our genome haploid is, do you know that? Yeah, 3.2 billion, okay? And the average chromosome is something like 200 million base per length, so it's like a huge sequence, and you have to cut. Do you know how long is the maximum fragment that you can sequence in a Sanger run? More or less, just to say. Uh-huh. Yeah, I didn't get the first 500, correct. Okay. You can sequence 500 bases at a time. And since you cannot do it in between all the other fragments of DNA that you cut, you have to isolate it. So isolating a fragment of DNA requires cloning. You say, oh, I can use PCR. You can use PCR when you know the sequence already, because you have to design primers. If you don't know the sequence already, no way. You have to put your fragments in plasmids, you remember plasmids, or in viruses like bacteriophages or something like this. Then transforming bacteria, and then selecting singular clones, and then making sequences of all of them. That means millions of bacterial clones that have to be sequenced. To find the story. And actually it was an incredible story. And also, since the genome is so large, so huge, they couldn't directly clone to plasmid small fragments of DNA, because it was too many, So they have to make a kind of hierarchical cloning. They first used bags or packs that are vectors that can host something like 100 to 200 kilo bases of DNA each, so huge vectors, cloning, separating, and then subcloning each of them in cosmids on other phage-derived vectors that are hosting something like 20 to 40 kilo bases each, and then subcloning again each of them in plasmids, and then sequencing. So that was a kind of story. And the 23 laboratories actually took each laboratory took one chromosome, okay, and tried to run this. I visited personally one of these laboratories in 2003 in Japan, the Riken Institute in Japan. And it's incredible, because it's something like, you know, a gym, you know, that's an enormous room with full of sequencers, nothing else than sequencers. So they had something like 100 or something sequences. They were making sequences in parallel and trying to get. Actually, the Riken Institute was the one who sequences the largest chromosome. But anyway, it's kind of fantastic. Anyway, so the reason is to have. The final story that increased even more the task. So the difficulty of getting the sequence made, it was that you don't know anything. You cannot sequence fragments like this, cutting and then sequencing each individually, because you don't know the order of the fragments. So you have to clone it redundant in order to have fragments that are redundant, means that the sequence here is the same as the sequence here. Okay? So when you try to reconstruct the sequence, you have borders with the same sequences, you can reach it. Okay, otherwise, no way. So they actually used a redundant library, and then this increased a lot the number of sequences they made. Anyway, if you want, in this link that I showed you here, you can also download, if you want, it's quite light. There is all the story, and it describes how the scientists made this kind of sequence. But to make the story short, they arrived to this sequence identity in the first draft was in 2001, and the final draft was in 2003. So you were small, really small kids at that time. And okay, they try to annotate the sequence, because the sequence is just, you know, letters, and nothing else than letters. And so you have to annotate, means that to find meaning of the parts of the sequences and whatsoever. So what they did was to take, of course, all the known genes already, and then making arrangements, and then they used the criteria of sequence homology. Do you know that, for example, many proteins are encoded by, they have similar sequence, so they are encoded by similar genes. For example, if you know the EGF receptor, I tell you something that you know, the EGF receptor, okay, has a sequence, and there are other three genes in human that are called RB2, RB3 and RB4, you heard about that. They have a very similar sequence. So in that time, we knew only the EGF receptor, but when you find a sequence somewhere in the chromosomes that is similar to that one, you say, okay, this is probably something similar, a gene similar to that one. Okay, you can study and so on. So they try to make this kind of story. And then they try to look for correspondence to RNA and proteins, of course, because you find a gene and then you have no RNA in any cell type. It probably is not a gene, of course. And then making proteins, of course, and then try to isolate, identify all the repeated sequences that are present in the genome, and then try to match also from the phylogenetic point of view, because in the same time there were other laboratories that were running sequences of the mouse, sequences of fish, plants, yeast, or whatever, so putting together and finding homologies and try to reconstruct. It was a good story. So this is the 2003 version, okay? They were, I don't remember, they made something like 12 samples from 12 individuals. So the first version was a kind of average of different individuals, but not that many, okay? So when looking inside of this genome, the genome was divided. This is the original picture taken from that paper in 2003. So the original genome is 3.2 gigabase, okay? And then you divide in what they could map as a gene or gene-related, okay? And they found only 1,000.2 megabases, okay? So something like one-third of the genome that was related to genes. And this included both coding regions. Coding means, of course, where you have the famous ORFs, and this a tiny amount, as you can see, this is 48 mega. You see, it's a 1.5%. It's a nothing. And then when you say related, means all the stories that are maybe genes, but are not directly coding sequences. So introns, untranslated regions here, or pseudogenes. Do you know what pseudogenes are? No. Or gene fragments. You don't know what are pseudogenes? Some of you did. Some of you don't. You do? Say, please. You don't remember. Pseudogenes, you know that evolution of the genomes were made by duplication of segments, and then selection by the common story of selection. Okay, so mutation and then selection and so on. So our genomes is full of pseudogenes or gene fragments that are derived for duplication of real genes, okay, and they don't work anymore. So you can find them because the sequence is more or less the same, okay, but since they accumulated a lot of mutations, they are not working anymore. But this is the mechanism the genomes produced different proteins, okay? Before I was mentioning AGF receptor and RB2, RB3, RB4, and they derive exactly from this mechanism, okay? Duplication and then selection of the other gene. If they work, they become novel gene. If they don't work, they become pseudogenes. So that's the reason. Today we know that more or less each coding gene in our genome has at least one pseudogene somewhere. Okay. So it makes a lot. I mean, the fraction of coding as compared to the related is really teeny, nothing. Okay, and all the rest of genome was classified as intragenic DNA, and they classified it in interspersed repeats and other. Other means that they had no idea about them, so they classified as that one. This interspersed repeat takes something like 1.4 giga and was composed of lines. I told you already, long interspersed elements. These signs, short interspersed elements. LTR elements, they are called LTR because, do you know what is LTR, right? You don't. Long terminal repeat is the characteristic regulatory sequence of retroviruses. That is both sides of the coding of the retrovirus. And as you can see, our genome is full of these remnants of who knows when infection by retroviruses, okay, during evolution. And then you have transposons and DNA that are a different kind of mobile elements. Okay. And then in this other intragenic, there are something that we know that are microsatellites and other sequences that they didn't know what they are. The classification today is a little different from this one because fortunately we discovered function of a part of this unknown DNA, okay? For example, we localized that many of the sequences present in this intragenic DNA actually are transcribed in non-coding RNA with functions. So we are mapping and understanding. But anyway, some kind of idea is got from that story. So you can go, if you want to know the situation today, this actually is an old slide, it's taken from last year. This is one of the repositories of the, do you know that? Ever seen Ensemble? Some of you yes, some of you no. This is the European Molecular Biology Laboratory, and actually it has a repository of the DNA sequences. We will see it many times, so don't worry about it. And if you go there is human assembly gene annotation. You can see here, you don't see, but I can read it for you. And this is something like 20,000 coding genes, 22,000 non-coding genes, and so on. So you, if you want to have information about what is the today knowledge about the genome, just go to this site, okay? Click over and then look for statistics and you will see what is our actual today knowledge about the genome. Okay, so this gene counts, but let me see, looking all the stories. So this is a more recent review, was not the situation in 2003, was a review written in 2012, so something like 10 years later, in which people try to understand. And this is the situation about repetitive sequences. And you see here that you have mini satellites, micro satellites, or satellites. Do you know what are satellites? Satellites are small sequences that are repeated head to tail. Like, for example, ATG, 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 ATG 1,000 times. Okay? They're short and repeated many, many times. And they're more or less spread around our genome. We have something like 426,000 mini satellites or microsatellites repeats in our genome. Okay, length is from 2 to 10. From 100 base pairs. So, from 2 means, for example, 80, 80, 80. Then the signs. So short interspersed repeat. They are elements that are from 100 to 300 base pair long. We have something like 1,800,000 each of them. Wherever, okay? So if you divide our length by the number of this sign, can you do it? Just approximate. Consider this not 1.8, consider 2. That's easier to make, 2 millions. Then you divide the length, that is 3 giga, 0.2, by this number. What will give you? Yeah, 1.6 kilobase. Okay, so it means that every 1.6 kilobases of our DNA, there is one of these repeats. It's horrible. I mean, you find them in introns, in promoters, in UTRs, wherever. Okay, so it's a kind of spreading of these repeats. Then DNA transposons, you have the length is from 200 to 2,000. You have something like 500,000 copies of these transposons. I know, it's impressive. I know. And then you have LTR retrotransposons that are this virus-derived story. You have 700,000 copies of them. The length is more or less this one. This is line. Line is another story. It's long interspersed repeats. They are longer, from 500 to 8,000 base pairs long, and we have something like 1.5 million copies of these lines. And the reasoning is the same as you did before. So they are spread everywhere. We find lines everywhere. Okay. And then this is something that you know better. This is RNA, so ribosomal RNA encoding DNA. And these are organized usually in tandem repeats. We have 700 copies of this gene, but this is functional, of course. And the length is this one. And then we have segmental duplication of other classes, just put all together, another story of 2,000 copies. So this makes, and this is the distribution in chromosomes. You see that, if you see the blue one is line, this is sign, and this is the percentage on each chromosome that you have. Okay. Quite even, it's not very different from one chromosome to the other one. Yep. Sorry?
What are sign elements?
Sign elements. I have a slide after that. Okay, so this is just a number. Let me skip it. Only to say that they are in subtypes, because they are very similar to each other. Okay, so there are classes of each of them. Side line. There are line one, line two, line three that are recognized by the sequence that are very similar. Okay. Just that. Okay. So, wait, I try to answer to the... Okay, this is line, this is sign, just to explain you what they are. They are... Okay, lines are larger, they are not in scale. Okay, so you imagine that the line something like 2,000, the other one like 200, so it's much smaller. And they have a typical organization in which you find a 5' UTR and 3' UTR, and in between there are ORFs. So there are coding sequences inside. Okay, of course they are hypervariable sequences. So in all, not in all of the copies that you find in a line, the ORF is real ORF. Okay, this variously mutated, and probably most of them are not functional and so on. But in some of them they are functional, and what they encode is a homing couple of enzymes. Homing means enzymes that are capable of retrotranscribing. Retrotranscribing means making retro copies of RNA and homing them in a different place of the genome. Okay? Do you understand the concept? These are occasionally transcribed in an RNA that is made from here to here. Okay? This RNA can encode four proteins, ORF1, ORF2. One of this protein is RT, so retrotranscriptase. It will take this RNA and make a retrocopy in DNA, exactly as retroviruses do. Okay? And this DNA is homed, that means is inserted in the chromosome, in another part of the chromosomes, by this endonuclease that is a homing endonuclease, with let me say, okay? So don't be impressed. It happens only one time each 200 generations. So in your body, in this moment, there is no active story like this one. Don't worry, okay?
The product of this RNA retrotranscribes this RNA?
Yeah. No, not retrotranscribe this RNA. Okay, the product of this RNA will be translated by the normal ribosome of the cells. Okay, the cell will produce RT and endonuclease, the two enzymes that are encoded by this guy. Okay, the retrotranscriptase will retrotranscribe the RNA into a molecule of DNA, exactly as retroviruses do. Do you know the story of retroviruses? It's the same, okay? And this piece of DNA that is made is inserted in any part of the chromosome by the end and the nucleus.
This specific RNA is retranscribed or some other RNAs?
Maybe also some other RNAs. Actually, there are many mysterious things in the genome, maybe that also will retranscribe randomly some other RNA, but we don't know. Yeah.
So the genome becomes more larger.
Larger. Yeah.
There is no meaning of this mechanism.
Well, this is probably a virus-derived mechanism. I mean, it's of course it has contributed to our evolution, of course, because it spread novel sequences all around, and these sequences are probably can be used. For example, we found a lot of these signs, sequences, we found in promoters. And probably they were used to make it. Also, this LTR, for example, UTR and UTR, they are full of transcription factor binding sites. And we find this small piece in all the enhancers. We made a paper, I show you. In which we saw that actually many of the enhancers that are dependent, they respond to the estrogen stimulus in cells, they have a sequence that is very conserved and derives from a particular sign. So it's a kind. And also exons, sometimes novel exons are derived from exonization of signs. So it probably has been a force for evolution of the genomes, but also probably also the reason why the genomes tolerate to have so many sequences in between. Otherwise, no reason. I mean, okay, so this is the structure of the line, and the sign is just a part, probably, is just a part of the messenger RNA. Because as you can see, they always terminate with a small poly A sequence. And the poly A sequence is a mark of RNA. You remember that all RNA ends with a poly A. So probably this is a part of retrotranscribed RNA that has been homed somewhere in the nucleus. But this is not coding, okay? So the signs are not coding anything, okay? Only the lines are encoding something. We have to move on. Okay. Oh yeah, this is probably the answer to some of your questions. Sometimes you have a gene, a normal gene, okay, that produces RNA, and then if you have any kind of RT enzyme for any reason, for a line who has produced the RT, or for a virus infection in which you have some RT expressed in the cell, you can have a retrocopy. You can have a copy in DNA, and this can be inserted everywhere. And this insertion may give rise to novel genes or to pseudogenes, for example. Okay. Yeah.
The RT proteins are responsible also for the insertion.
No. The RT proteins only retrotranscribe the RNA. Okay. Insertion is due to endonucleases, but since we have, you know, you remember probably the maintenance enzyme, DNA repair, you remember? DNA repair mechanisms, they are active in all the cells. So sometimes for error, of course, this is not a normal physiological situation, but it may be that the mechanism of DNA repair find a small DNA and say, oh, okay, I have to join it with another break. It can happen, but you have to think about this, all this story, in an evolutionary term, so hundreds of generations. Okay, yes, please.
Gene-related sequences encode for proteins?
They do not.
Okay, so what's the difference between regulatory genes, which don't encode for proteins, and regulatory RNAs from the interspace?
Well, the difference is philosophical, in the sense that we classify as we want. I mean, in that period of time, in 2003, people was oriented to classify as a gene only the coding sequence. But today, the things are completely changed. We cannot say that introns, for example, is not gene. Introns are genes, because they have function. Important function in the genes. So today we will classify all this story as a gene. Okay. Okay. So coming back, I had all the other stories to show you. Okay. How are these sequences organized in genome? No logic. I mean, we didn't find any logic in the topological organization of the genome. This is just a piece of DNA from human genome that is a 50 kilobase starting from here and arriving to here. Okay? Just to show you. And the color code will explain you how are the genes that you find here, exon, introns, exon, introns, okay? And then lines. This signs, okay, just to show you a random piece, just to give you an idea of what is. And then you have transposons, and then LTR elements and microsatellites that are there and there. I mean, random. There is nobody today that has understood any kind of logic in this organization, okay? Good. Then, repetitive sequence, I told you the microsatellites, okay, where they are actually interspersed in the genome, but there are specific places in which we find repetitive sequences. And as you remember, there are telomeres, for example. You remember the story of replication at the telomeres, there is a repetitive sequence, okay. These are small sequences like this one that are repeated 2,000 and 3,000 times in the end of the chromosome. These are called microsatellites. Okay, and the centromere is the same. You have again repetitive satellite sequences that there is varied. I mean, in the while the telomere repeats are species specific. So in human we have always the same in all the chromosomes. Okay, the centromeric repeat are variable. So it's not a story. Is that the structure of repetitive sequence? The repetitive sequence in the telomere, as you know, they bind proteins and they make a kind of terminal end structure, and they are functional not to make the chromosome shorter. But this is another story. Okay, I don't have any other story. Okay, and so in that time, 2003. People were saying, okay, our DNA, our genome is only very little coding and functional, and most of the sequence was thought to be redundant and repetitive and essentially junk. This was the theory. Say, if you take a paper at that time, they say, okay, everything in the genome is junk. No meaning. Okay, but the problem is that this conclusion was of course adversed by, especially by geneticists, in which they found a reason for having sequences in the genomes, and so they started to make a kind of movement to force the scientific community to take the story seriously, not junk, okay, and starting to make projects. And actually in those years there are several projects that started to systematically analyze the function of all the elements in the genome. Okay, okay, and there were several projects that were very, very different from each other. One was the comparative. So they started to make a kind of genome sequences of everywhere, okay, all the organisms. And most of them actually are publicly funded, so they are available in databases. And if you have few minutes to spend, you can go to, for example, to NCBI Genomes on this link, and then, for example, ask for, we don't have time today. This is an active link, but we don't have time today. You will do it if you are interested. You click over there, and then we'll see how many mammals, for example, have been sequenced today. We have hundreds of mammals that have been sequenced. And this increases enormously our knowledge of the story, because there is one common motif when you compare genomes. If a sequence has been conserved, for example, you examine, I don't know, vertebrates. You take amphibians, and reptiles, and then birds, and then, okay, and you compare the genomes, and you find a sequence that we classified before as a intergenic, nonsense, junk sequence. And then you find that this sequence is conserved all through the evolution. It's much difficult to say that it's junk, okay? You don't conserve junk, usually. So our genome is full of very conserved sequences, and so scientists of course started to say, okay, this hyper-conserved region probably has meaning. Do you mind if I skip the interval, or you want to stop? You want to stop? Today is not that difficult, I mean, it's just, okay. So I finish a little earlier, okay? Tell me. Okay. So, and this is comparative, just to show you how the genomes are different. Okay, when you compare mammals, the organization is more or less the same. When you compare vertebrates, you find some kind of general philosophy. But when you compare genomes in between different, really different organisms. The organization is very different. Okay, so in this slide, you compare a human piece of DNA, actually, is the same that you saw before, the 50 kilo bases that were zoomed out, and this is zoom is shorter here, from here to here. This is Saccharomyces cerevisiae genome, a random piece, okay, 50 kilo bases. This is Drosophila melanogaster, so insect, and this is a plant, the mace is plant, okay? And the color code is the same, okay? And what you see here clearly is that when you look at the Saccharomyces cerevisiae, this is already a eukaryote, okay? It has a nucleus, has chromosomes, exactly. It works as our genome do. But if you see here, almost is green. What means green means genes, encoding proteins, okay? And you see that there are no real intergenic spaces, very short. And in all these species, there is only one virus-derived sequence, that is this TIE2. Okay, so many genes, few repetitive sequences. Okay, look at the Drosophila melanogaster is a kind of intermediate in between the human and the yeast. So you have many genes, but also you have several interspecies elements like this one, and so on. And also, as you can see, the introns are shorter. In humans, usually you have huge introns, something like this one or this one, okay? And when you go to plants, this is a completely different situation. Because, as you can see, in plants, most of the genome, plants usually have huge genomes. Sometimes very much larger than the human or mammals or vertebrates or whatever. But the reason is that they are completely made of repetitive sequences. If you look at this piece of DNA from mice, all these violet sequences are repetitive. All these violet sequences are repetitive. And there is only one single gene in between. So enormous genomes, but they're really full of what they say, junk, I don't know, anyway. And then few genes interspersed in it. So the genomes change a little bit. And just to make comparison, just to have an idea about it. Okay? So now looking at, for a few minutes, we forget about genomes, looking at genes, how the genes are organized. As you know, all the genes in eukaryotes are exon introns. Okay, they are present in all eukaryotes, also in the yeast, also in Saccharomyces. But the number and the length of introns and exons is very different from genome to genome, to organism to organism. Okay, so this is a comparative view of the average number of introns per gene. Okay, so we took all the genes that we know, made the statistics, and find the average number. You see, this is a Saccharomyces here, and this is Drosophila melanogaster that you saw before. This is the worm, the small worm, and this is a plant, and this is most musculus, and finally this is human. Okay. So as you can see, the number of introns per gene is very low in Cerevisiae. Cerevisiae has a very low number. Cerevisiae has 6,000 and something genes overall, and maybe 200 genes have an intron, one single intron, so small. But if you go to Homo sapiens here, you see that the number of introns is something like 8.8. So we have an average of 8.8 introns per gene. This doesn't mean that we don't have zero introns. There are some genes in the human that are intronless. Few of them, but some, okay? So there are intronless genes. And some of them has a huge number of introns. So the range is very, very high. Okay, human genome, number of exon, 8.8. Exon length, average. Exon length, 170 base pairs. Intron length 5040/20/420. And the range, as you can see, is intron from 0 to several. We have 3,000 single exon genes in the genomes, and we have a max number of introns of 147 introns per in a single gene. This is the NEB neurexin gene. It's extremely fragmented. Okay? So this is what I told you in a visual fashion. So this compares Homo sapiens, the worm, and the insect, as comparing the exon length. This is very interesting from a functional point of view, because as you can see, this C. elegans is blue, the blue line here, and the Drosophila melanogaster is this red line that's more or less actually is similar to the worm. And as you can see, the exon length is something like 170, but then you have a lot of exons that are higher than this one. When you look at the human genome, you have the same peak here, that is 170, as you have seen on the slide before, but then it falls down very quickly. So there are really a thin amount of exons that are over 200 or 300, okay? So the length of exons actually has shortened during evolution, okay? And this is the intron length, same story. So you look for blue and red, they are the intron length of Drosophila and Caenorhabditis, and you see that most of the introns in those organisms are short, okay, short and short, okay? And few introns are longer than 2,000, okay? But if you look at the human situation, it's the other way around. Okay, you have very few introns that are short. You have a high number of introns that stands from 100 to 2,000. Okay, and then also longer introns are present in our genome. So there is a tendency in the evolution to make genomes more to make genes more fragmented. So increasing number of exons and introns, shortened the exons, okay, and increasing intron length. This is the evolutionary tendency that we see from comparative studies. Okay, what about the coding sequence? Can you resist? I found you a little bit tired. What about the length of the ORF? Because we have seen, okay, before, we have seen. Number of exons changes, the number of the length changes, and so on. Does the length of the coding sequence also varies? It does not. That's another very, very, very funny thing, very curious thing, if you think about. So all the genomes have evolved by changing stories. But if you look at the ORF product, okay. So what is in this table? I help you. Okay, this is the size of the genome in megabases, millions of bases. Okay, we are there, Homo sapiens. This is the plant. This is Drosophila melanogaster, this is Saccharomyces cerevisiae, and other. Just look at those four, don't be lost, okay? This is the number of ORFs, ORFs standing for open reading frames, so coding sequences, okay? And you see we are placed here, more or less. You see different numbers, don't worry. It depends on the moment of the history period in which we derived this story, but more or less it's there. Okay, this is the number in Caenorhabditis. I told you that the worm has more or less the same number of genes we do, and so on. But look at this is actually the ORF mean size. Okay, And this is the standard deviation of the mean. So if you measure the length of the ORFs, I'm saying coding sequences of all those genes, you find that more or less, with one exception, this is a fish, but more or less, you see that they are more or less the same. Do you agree? And also, if you look at the standard deviation, it's not that different. Okay, that means that the range of the proteins are more or less the same. Do you can to imagine why? I mean, you have genomes that are so different from each other, but then the proteins, protein length, is more or less the same. Do you imagine one possible reason for that conservation? Nobody knows, actually. I'm just trying to tell you, try to imagine why. Any guess? Any crazy explanation that you can find?
Maybe it's related to the process of translation. If each protein is more or less the same dimension, I don't know, maybe the key to investigate.
Yeah. Actually, the more, I mean, you are quite right to say in the sense, but the more accredited explanation for this conservation is folding. Apparently, when you have larger protein, the folding in the current structure becomes difficult and exponentially difficult. So there is probably a physical limit to the kind of protein you can realize. But this is a guess, it's not proven, so I don't know. Okay, so just registering what we see. Okay, so the average amino acid number is 128. And the okay. That's it. Okay, so this is another vision of the same story. You have different kind of genus here: fungi, plant, bacteria, archaea, and so we are vertebrates are there, vertebrate mammals are there. And this is the average protein size. You see that the average protein size is more or less conserved in between 300 and something amino acid and something like here. Okay, 550, something like that. Okay. And this is the, if you look at the number of proteins, of course there are higher difference because the small bacteria, they have a lower number of proteins. We plants have enormous number of proteins. Vertebrates are in between, like this. And these are the extreme. I mean, if you take only the shorter proteins, okay, you take the 10% percentile of the shorter protein, you find this distribution. You see, again, there is no difference, more or less no difference, okay? This is the number of amino acid here, okay? And if you look at the 19th percentile, that means the largest protein, again, there is not that much difference in between the organs. More or less, it's the same. Okay, so I don't think to talk about other aspects of genetics, you probably know, I don't know. Do you know what are paralogs, paralogy, orthology? You know, probably. You do? Yeah, you do. Okay. Anyway, there is an evolution there, a green spot. So please take care of just if you don't remember what, for example, genes families are or similarity in parts of proteins, the domains of protein, you should probably know from the. And the mechanism of evolution. I don't want to talk about those. The aspect, there are genetics. This is not molecular biology. So. Okay, just to remember you that this is quite important in thinking about the story. So at that point, At that point, that I am meaning in 2003, people started, as I told you, started to make analysis, so trying to give a functional meaning of all these kind of sequences. And so there were many projects starting, okay? Project like comparative, as I told you, human genetic variation, another very important story. Never heard about it? 1,000 genomes project, you heard that about it? 1,000 genome project started in 2003, and the objective was to have the complete sequences of 1,000 genomes from 1,000 individuals from different ethnies and ethnological groups by the end of the 2020, so in a couple of years from now. And actually, the problem is that they have now much more than 1,000 genomes made, just because they started with the Sanger sequencing. And now there is NGS, so they accelerated a lot. So this is the reason why. And then another very important project is the phenotype-genotype correlation. What is phenotype-genotype means? If I am blonder hair or dark hair, what is the gene that determines the color of the hair? This phenotype-genotype. Or if I have any kind of predisposition to a disease, like Alzheimer or cystic fibrosis or whatever else, what is the predisposition? Where is the gene? Where is the variant that will tell me this kind of risk and so on? So these studies are called GWAS, that means genome-wide association studies. Okay, it takes a lot of time because you have to take a statistically significant number of patients or individuals and to compare with another corresponding number of normal, say, individuals, and then to find all the difference in the genes is really tough, okay? And finally, gene expression and phenotype, because this is another story. Can a phenotype be determined not by the sequence itself, but by the expression of genes? Okay, so you have to profile gene expression in all the individuals, in all the tissues, and then try to find a correlation with some phenotype. So this is a very tough story, and this is genetics, okay? And also, in the same time, there were many studies like ENCODE and Phantom Project that started to give different stories to the genome. So they were not studying the sequence itself. They were studying epigenomics, for example, where, for example, methylation to cytosis is present, okay? Where histone modification map to a genome. How are the chromatin status in different kind of cells, and then protein to DNA interaction, okay, systematically in all the cell types, in all the stories. And then the transcriptomics, that means studying which part of the genomes are actually transcribed in either coding or non-coding RNAs. So this was a enormous project, because genetics, of course, is usually germline genetics. I mean, for each individual, you have only one DNA. It's big, it's large, but it's only one DNA to be sequenced, okay? While when you go to epigenomes, like in the second part here, you have to take care that each type of cell from different tissues will have a specific profile of epigenetics, okay? So you have not to take care of one individual, but many, many hundreds of different kind of cells, okay? That takes an enormous time. Okay, so this is the principal project, so the human genetic variation and genetic analysis of disease, and then functional annotation of human genome, and this is the one of the largest project that started, that is this ENCODE, that means Encyclopedia of DNA Elements, and the goal was not was quite impressive, because they started the project stating on the site. I remember the first time I saw the site was this sentence: "But our idea is to obtain functional information of every single nucleotide of the human genome." Okay, good. A good ambitious project, anyway. And this project actually started in these years using Sanger, and then around 2006 they turned on the next generation sequencing that actually allowed the first draft completed in 2012. Okay, in 2012 the ENCODE project printed something like 30 articles on the journal Nature, describing all the results that they had in this project, and it's actually a milestone to in the story of functional genomics. Okay, you have to remember that. From the point of view of genetics, as I told you, we have to talk about variants. It has become very quickly clear that our genomes are not the same. Actually, it was supposed already, because since I told you I have blonde hair, the one has dark hair, dark eyes, and blue eyes, and so on, it means that something different is in the genome. But since a few years ago, it was thought that the difference were few. Okay, so I remember that when the project started, people were saying, okay, we will probably map something like from 5,000 to 10,000 small differences. Completely wrong. We know today that we have something like 3-5 million single nucleotide polymorphisms. That means a single nucleotide variant in between all of us. Okay, so it's making a lot of difference. And when you will go to the laboratory, to the informatic laboratory, you will see that when you have a gene sequence, you will see all the gene sequences colored because all the bases are colored if they have variants in the human population, and you will see that it's impressive how many of those have been mapped. Okay, but some of these variants have no phenotype or very little evidence of a phenotype. Okay, most of them are silent. You remember the story of the redundancy of the triplets in the coding sequence, right? So the third nucleotide of the triplet usually can vary without affecting the amino acid encoded, so they are so called silent mutation. Okay, or they have a very, very tiny phenotype. Some variants, on the contrary, are associated to phenotype, evident phenotype, and some variants are clearly associated to specific pathologies. Okay? Good. I just show you one abstract or one paper. This is the first paper that appeared from the 1000 Genomes Project Consortium. But just to tell you something, because they arrived at that point. And they actually had this kind of sequence. How here we present results of the pilot phase, so it was only the pilot phase of the project, okay? Designing to develop and compare different strategies for genome-wide sequencing and with high-throughput platforms. So they were starting already with this kind of NGS story, okay? We undertook three projects: low coverage whole genome sequences of 179 individuals, so few of them, not 1,000. Okay. Low coverage, please take it in your mind, I will explain it later on. High coverage sequences of two mother, father, child trios, mother, father, and child. to detect if any variation occurs during reproduction. Okay, this is very important. Okay, and they had high coverage of sequencing of these two trios. And exon targeted sequences of 697 individuals from seven populations. This exon targeted is called also exome, and I will explain you in a short time what it is. Okay. And then results, we describe the location, allele frequency, and local haplotype structure of approximately 15 million single nucleotide polymorphisms. Okay? 1 million short insertion and deletion, so DNA that has inserted or deleted from, okay? And 20,000 structural variants, okay, most of which were previously undescribed. Structural variants mean that the structure of the gene has changed. For example, an intron has been removed, or a line has been inserted, or something like this. This is structural variation. Okay. On average,
we show that because we have cataloged the vast majority of common variants, over 95% of the current accessible variants found in any individual are present in this data set. So they say that 95% of all the common variants known before are actually present in this data set. And they say that this is very important. On average, each person is found to carry approximately 250 to 300, keep yourself well awake, 200 to 300 loss of function variants in annotated genes. This is impressive. Do you know what is a loss of function variant? Means that the variant will kill the gene. So we carry, each of us carry something like 250 to 300 loss of function variants. Impressive. And 50 to 100 variants previously implicated in inherited disorders. Wow. Okay, so this is, again, very impressive. And the other one is this. The next sentence is also impressive. We estimated here, from the two trios, we directly estimate the rate of de novo germline base substitution to be approximately 1 to the minus 8 per base pair per generation. So they could see that you have something like 30 variation in the chromosome, father, mother, that you find with the child. So this is the rate of normal background mutations that you find in human reproduction. And this is great. Okay. So this is 2010 paper from the consortium. Now they have, of course, they have, I don't remember. You can go to the site and see. I think they are close to have 6,000 individuals sequenced. So okay. So all this was possible from the discovery of next generation sequences. I know that you know all of this story. You don't? Yeah, everybody knows about the NGS. Say, okay. Let me just discuss with you shortly two or three things about the next generation sequencing, and then move on. Okay. The main difference in between Sanger is that Sanger has to isolate fragments, okay, to clone fragments. In this case, in all the technical exception of NGS, you don't need to separate fragments. All the fragments are sequences together in the same run, in the same technical. So no cloning step required. What we call high parallel sequences of fragments. Okay? And the story just needs to physically separate
all the fragments you produce. Okay. So usually the next generation sequences is made by generating what we call DNA nanoclones. That means you reproduce the same fragment several times to be able to sequence it. Okay. Then you have a high parallel in situ sequencing, a story in which you make not in the tube sequences, but on a surface, on beads or whatever. And the story is that you usually will get readout of millions of short sequences that we call reads, okay? And then you have just to align to the genomes or assembly. To make an imagination of what you do in the case of DNA is that so you take a donor DNA and like our DNA, for example, you fragment. And fragmentation is usually accomplished by sonication or by... also, you can use restriction enzyme digestion, but usually it's just a sonication. Then you make, to each of these fragments, you make adapter ligation. So you use two fixed sequences that you know very well, that are the red bars that you see on the side. Okay, you make a ligation. So all the millions of fragments that you generated here will be ended by the same sequence. Okay, and this point you have to find a way to physically separate all these fragments. Okay, and to sequence them in parallel. Okay, then all the technological. There are several biotech companies that develop a different machine to run this kind of sequences. And so the most popular one, which is the one produced by Illumina, has a surface separation. So they use glasses, okay? Surface, and then they bind all the fragments using a complementary primer that is on the surface of the glass. Okay, so all the fragments will make a kind of forest of fragments on the story. But other technologies, there are the Roche, for example, technology, they put the fragments on beads, small beads, and then they will put the beads on a kind of grid and will sequence them in that way. And other ones use nanowells, but I mean, it's just kind of different technological device. The story is that you have fragments and you sequence from an end, okay? So sequences is very similar to the Sanger sequencing because you make cycles of adding nucleotide, okay? Okay, so you have a primer here. This is the primer that is complementary to the adapter. And then you synthesize one hit per cycle, the sequence, okay? So you add one nucleotide at a time that of course will be complementary to the sequence here, okay? Easy to understand. The less easy to understand how you can add one nucleotide at a time and then wait for the next, and then wait for the next. So for example, in Illumina technology, you have modified nucleotides that have a 3' block and a 5' block. Okay, and then the base is fluorescent, so there is a fluorescent dye attached to the base. Okay, so you remove the first, and you make the first reaction. You register with a camera the light, okay, and then you will remove both the 5' end block and the fluorescent. So you don't see any anymore, okay? You wash everything away, and then you repeat the cycle, okay? So you have new nucleotides with the 3', and then with the fluorescent dye, and then with the, okay? Have you understood more or less? There are movies in the Moodle site, okay? At the end, there is NGS movies you can watch so you can understand how it works. It's short movies, in 2-3 minutes you understand everything. It's very easy. Okay, so you synthesize cycle by cycle. It's quite a slow process. It takes hours to make it because you have to, okay, you have to make the first nucleotide and wash everything away, then charge again the platform, and then so and so. And the Illumina actually uses four different colors. A is red, T is yellow, and so on and so. So you can distinguish, okay? And since the nanoclones are on the surface, you take cameras, pictures at this cycle, and it will tell you which bases in each clone are the kind of... Good. So the real powerful story is that on a glass, you have something like 800 million clones. So your camera will register 100 million sequences at a time. Okay, this is the power of the technology. Okay? It's incredible. Anyway, so how long do you go with the sequencing? I mean, how can you go far from this primer and to have the sequence? Okay, it depends on the technological advances. The very first machine that appeared in 2006, they were making very short reads, something like 30 to 35 bases long, no more than that. Now, of course, the technology evolved, and in the modern machine, you can go up to 200. Okay, so you can go up to 200 bases for each run. Okay, and the read length actually is defined by the number of cycles that you perform. And since this is the more costly, because these fluorescent-derived bases are very costly, actually usually we try to keep the red length to a minimum, just for the price of the story. Okay, so many times we make a particular trick that I mentioned because it's essential to you, because sometimes you see in the papers that people sequenced by this paired-end technology. This paired-end technology relies on the fact that when you make a nanoclone for a single fragment, you amplify with PCR, so you actually have both the strand and the anti-strand DNA on the same nanoclone. Okay, so all the sequences in the nanoclone are the same strand, many copies of the strand sequence and many copies of the anti-strand sequence. Okay, so you can sequence all the, say, strand by using this prime, this yellow primer, and so you will get sequence of, say, 50 nucleotides here. Okay, then you remove everything, wash everything away, and make again the sequence using the other primer here, the green one. So you will sequence 50 bases from the anti-strand. In this case, since the fragment is fixed length, because you select the size of the fragments, you will have a 50 base pair sequence from the left and another 50 sequence from the right. And since you know that they are distant, for example, I don't know, 200 bases, you can place them on the map of the genome in the correct way. So you actually save money because you don't sequence 400 bases or 500 bases, just the ends. But you know that they are connected in a fixed length. Okay, so that's a trick. Okay, so then you obtain millions and millions and billions of reads from a sequencing experiment. You have to map them to the reference genome. Okay, and this is what you study in bioinformatics course. Okay, so mapping the reads is not, if you think about it, it's not that difficult, but it can be difficult in some cases. Okay, and one important thing, you see here, there is a hole here. This is a gap. No read maps on this part of the genome. Why? This is because the fragmentation is random. It's random, okay? You take cells, for example, blood cells. You have 1 million cells in your thick, and then you extract DNA. So you have 2 million alleles
Okay? And then you fragment, but you cannot sequence all the fragments that you have. It's too costly. Okay? You sequence a part of them, so it's statistical. It's statistical. You can be very lucky and have reads that cover all your reference genome, but more realistically, you will have gaps. Okay? So just on the statistical basis, you can have something. So we call this coverage, okay? The percentage of reference genome that is represented in reads, we call it coverage. And this just depends on how much money you have to spend. If you're very rich, you can increase the sequencing, okay? You have all these fragments, okay? You make 2, 3, 4 times the sequencing, and then you will cover everything. If you are not rich, you will cover less. Okay, so this is only okay. And then also to other problem, like for example the speed, because if you increase the coverage, it takes a lot of time. Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yep.
I have understood that coverage was the number of time nucleotide or base pair is present on my so
wait.
I don't understand how the two definitions.
It's the same. It's the same definition because it's a statistical optic, if you want, a point of view. Okay, if you increase the number of reads. Okay, you will have all the genome covered. Okay, and then you will have many times the same nucleotide. So you can measure or say what is the average number of times that I see a specific nucleotide or the number of gaps that I have.
So in a certain way, if I cover all the genome, I could use the second definition because each nucleotide would be represented by one.
Yeah. In practical terms, if you cover a sequence by, let's say, 10 times a read, you are much more sure of that sequence. At the same time, you will have all the sequence covered. It's kind of the same story. Okay, so let's skip this one because it's not really okay. So just saying the length is important, the length. I stop in a few minutes, so don't be worried. Let me see. Okay, this is an example of coverage. Okay, we go until here. Three slides left. Okay. So this is the maximum read length in different NGS platforms. This is Illumina. This is the solid technology. This is called Ion Torrent. And this is the Roche 454. This is only the five most common platform commercially available today. And you see that this is the red length. Okay, this is the first version of the machine, and this is the most modern version of the machine. And you see that in Illumina, they started with 35, arrived to 300 today. Roche started with 110, they arrived at 2,000 today. And so on, just not examine everything. But this is very important, not for human. For humans, it's not really very important, the read length, because we know the genome sequence. The problem arises when you have to sequence a novel organism. When you start the novel sequencing, it is very important to have long reads, because remember that you have to assemble the sequence. So if you have this teeny reads, it's a mess, okay? So, for example, this Pacific Bio uses a completely different technology, and as you can see, it arrives until 20,000 length for each read. So it's a completely different technology. Okay, there is a site you can look at the site to know what. Okay, and this is the maximum throughput. That means the number of reads that you can have in a single run. You see. So you have, this is the max throughput per run in gigabase. The measurement is in gigabase, billions of of bases. Okay, and you see that the 454 is quite low performing, Illumina is very high performing, and so on. Okay, so there are differences in this kind of stories. The Illumina technology is the most successful technology today, but just for the kind of application that it covers. Okay, this is the coverage, okay, and you see that this definition is exactly what you said. The number of reads per read length per size of the target genome, okay, and this was a simple calculation just to see when you have, for example, running NGS of 50 base pair length, you obtain 200 million reads using whole genome DNA, that makes a coverage of 3.1 or something. This is absolutely not enough for genome sequencing. You will have an enormous number of gaps. To be sure, you have to increase to something like 30 time coverage. So you have to sequence much more than that. Okay. And finally, the final slide, so I can tell you bye-bye, is the cost. Just it finishes on 211, so it's not really adjourned. But please look at the cost of a single genome sequencing in the years. We start here. This is March 2002. Okay, when the sequence was published. One single genome, my genome, were costing, this is 10 to 8. How much it is? Dollars. $100 million. It's not a kidding. Okay? So that was the cost of a genome, single genome sequencing at that time. And then it decreased a little bit with just because the bioinformatics were much easier. Once you have a genome sequence, and making other genomes is much easier, okay? Because you can cover quite easily. Look at this. This is a break. You see that the decrease? This is the appearance of NGS. When NGS appeared today in the market, okay, the price for single genome fall down quickly. And we have the, okay, this is 7 years ago, but look at the price, please. The price is something like 10 to 4. That means $10,000 per genome. Now we are, try to continue. We are here. We are something like $1,000 per genome. So you can probably save your money, don't go on vacation this summer and make your genome sequencing. I'm kidding, but this is the reality. So we have something like $1,000 per genome in this practice. Okay, so you can just think how it is increased the number of genomes that you can get sequences now. Okay. Oh, we have the bioinformatics teacher now. I arrived exactly to the point where I told you yesterday.